Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Dan Thomas. Later on in the show, Gab Marcotti and Mark Ogden with me to discuss the possibility that the return of football could see the introduction of five substitutes. Meanwhile, it is 7 years to the day since Luis Suarez bit Ivanovic. We'll be getting Frank Leboeuf's reaction to that. Not happy still, despite all that time that has lapsed. He'll be discussing that with Ali Moreno. But we start, though, in Spain. Sid Lowe with us to discuss this possibility, Sid, that we could see Spanish teams back training sooner rather than later.
Yeah, this is based on the fact that the CSD, the Consejo Superior de Deportes, which is effectively Spain's sports minister, finally brought together Rubiales and Tebas, the head of the federation and the league, who have been at war for as long as anyone can remember, and basically sat them down and said, right, we're going to sort this out. And I think the way to sort it out is to effectively impose upon them a series of plans. Now, they went through the plans. There was an eight-hour meeting between the three of them, between Irene Lozano and Rubiales and Tebas. And the idea now is that they will lay down the protocols which enable clubs to go back into training and then, if all goes well from there, of course, to restart competition in La Liga, almost certainly behind closed doors. Now, the first thing to say here, of course, is that all of this is dependent on the rules to do with the state of emergency in Spain, on the rules to do with the lockdown. Now, that has already obviously gone well beyond the point at which we expected to go from at the very start. This started on the 14th of March. It will continue into May now. But the hope is that after this weekend, there can be some relaxation of those rules and maybe then the beginning of a process that enables Spanish clubs to go back into training. That said, of course, while we haven't yet been given the details, we do know from what La Liga has said previously, the beginning of those training processes will be in small groups. They will be in clubs not going into the dressing room together, in players getting changed and showered at home. So I think it's some way off being a situation in which the clubs are actually ready to play.
However, when that does eventually happen, suggestions, reports said, I don't know where these have come from, that basically they want to mic up the players, the refs, the coaches to try and add a little bit of zing to it because, of course, when the games come back, they will be playing in front of empty stadiums.
Yeah, I must be honest with you here, Dan. I do not see for a minute the players agreeing to this. I think the players' union will have something to say if this does become firmed up as a plan. And I don't think they're going to accept it. I think maybe some clubs will. You've already seen this, by the way. I don't know if you how closely you watch Spanish TV coverage of La Liga, but you'll see that some clubs enable dressing rooms to have TV cameras in them. So you'll get the pre-match team talk from the manager. You'll get that little huddle before they go out of the players shouting, come on, we can win this. And then they'll follow them out onto the pitch. And that's normally an agreed slot of a minute or a minute and a half, which they can then put out. What happens is, of course, that this happens at some of the smaller clubs and not at the bigger ones. And those clubs will not let cameras anywhere near the dressing room. I do not believe for a minute that they will allow players to be mic'd up during the game and allow that to go out. Now, obviously, it is true that this is part of the thought process of La Liga because, of course, they're very well aware that in terms of the televisual product, and I must confess, it's not a phrase I like using, but in terms of the televisual product, the product loses something enormously without fans in the stadium. It loses atmosphere, it loses noise, it loses excitement. It loses a lot of what makes football great, and to be honest, without the fans, it won't feel the same. So, of course, what they're trying to do is to make up for what they lose by adding other things, and this is one of the ideas that they have. Okay, well, maybe we can hear the players. Maybe we can have some access that gives the TV spectator something back because they've lost something. Now, I suspect that what will happen is in the end we'll get an agreement that allows maybe some recording of a chat before the teams go out for the second half or some recording from inside the tunnel, which at some clubs we're already getting. But I don't think that clubs are going to be at all keen, and I don't think the players' union will be at all keen, to enable players to actually be mic'd up during the matches.
Meanwhile, of course, for Martin Braithwaite, what a year 2020 has been. Of course, at Leganés and then suddenly Barcelona come a knocking as an emergency replacement for Luis Suarez. Sam Marsden spoke to the Barcelona striker about what's happened over the last few months.
Are you sort of training once a day, twice a day in collaboration with the club, on your own?
Yeah, I'm doing some of the club's workout and then I'm doing something myself on the side. So during the day, it's usually like 2-3 workouts a day. I feel when I start training, it has to be really intense and I have to be 100% focused. And of course, it's really difficult when you're at home with the kids around. I saw that the first couple of days, like, you need to have a tight schedule like to say, okay, I'm training at this time and I'm doing it like this, because if you just wake up and go by the day will suddenly just have gone away, and you'll end up like 10 o'clock have to do a workout or something, because when you have kids, there's always something to do. So I feel that it has helped me a lot to just make a schedule for me. I know what time I'm training, eating my breakfast every day. So it makes it easier.
What Barca have missed a lot this season is that pace in behind. And when you have a passer like Messi, I guess it's easy for you just to make the runs and know, like you say, the balls are going to come if you keep making those runs.
Of course, that's the thing. And especially with Barcelona, you have Messi, he can do everything. He can do everything, and the team is going to focus a lot about him. So I just have to play my game, and my game is naturally running in behind. And I think it's not fun for other teams. You know, you have to look at Messi, but you have someone running in behind. So at least the defenders, they have to make a choice. Either they follow Messi or they follow me, and someone is going to get the space. You cannot play 90 minutes without giving us space. So that's the thing. The only problem is if everyone is just coming, trying to receive the ball in the feet, and no one is running behind, so they will make it easy for the defender. So luckily, that's my game. That's what I'm good at, to run behind. I can also come and get the ball, but I don't need it in the team because we have so many good players. So I'm just going to stay focused, running behind, making it really difficult for the defense, and putting them in a decision where they have to make a choice. They have to make a choice if they leave a space behind them or they leave a space in front of them. And the thing is, we just have to take advantage of that when we play. And we have so good players that I'm sure we're going to do that.
And how was that week when you signed for Barcelona with Leganés and stuff? Because obviously it was an exceptional signing, because it doesn't happen very often that the circumstances allow for a player to be signed outside the transfer window. But Leganés, in public at least, you know, they were very respectful, very professional. They seemed very accepting. I mean, was that the case with you once you transmitted to them your desire to leave?
Honestly, Leganés is an amazing club. The people who are working at the club, the best people. It's really, I cannot speak highly enough of that club. It was really special for me, and the way they treated me when I had to leave. Because sometimes, you know, when you're leaving a club, you can leave a club with mixed feelings. But they totally understood me, and they said, like, this is a chance, one chance in a lifetime, so you have to take it. They would have done the same, so they truly understand me. Of course, they felt it was not fair that they couldn't go out and get a replacement, which I understand. But at the end of the day, they were really, really nice to me.
And obviously, Javier Aguirre hadn't been the manager for long, but what was your experience like working with him for that brief time that you were with him as a coach?
Really good. He's like the player's man. You can really go and talk to him. He just told me, go and enjoy. He said, honestly, you have to go. It's your career. This is a big opportunity. Of course, you have to take it and just go and kill it and enjoy it.
Now you're at Barcelona, now you've shown that you can achieve what you've set out to achieve. There must be so much more that you're targeting in the future now.
Exactly. Now I'm at the biggest stage, and now it's about winning titles. So this is my aim. For everything that's possible to win everything, I want to win everything. And for me, like, I'm in Barcelona, I'm looking at all these legendary players who have played here and all the periods where they had some of the best teams. And for me, one of the goals is like to be able to say, you know, I played in one of the best Barca team in the generation. So I want people to be able to look back at the team I played in and say, like, yeah, it was one of the best teams that I've been in Barca's history. So this is a huge motivation for me, and it comes a lot of hard work, but I'm willing to put in the work, and I'm just excited.
Interesting stuff there from Martin Braithwaite. Sid Lowe is still with us. Sid, I don't mean this horrible, cynical person. And I understand, obviously, his aspirations to be part of a great Barcelona side. But surely the truth is that he'll be gone in the summer, won't he?
Well, I mean, that logic suggests that, doesn't it? But I think Braithwaite has the intelligence and the adaptability to make himself useful. I think, obviously, a lot will depend on the market as well, and whether or not there's an opportunity for Barcelona to recover their money. And I suspect there may not be, because, of course, he has to play between now and then the season. And bear in mind that one of the reasons why Barcelona were prepared to pay 18 million euros on the buyout clause to get Martin Braithwaite was that they thought that because of age, And because of the fact that he was going to have a European Championships and would probably therefore become a valued product, if you like, during the market, there was a good chance that they would be able to sell him on and either make a profit or at least recover their money. Now, that one half of that has gone. Maybe even both halves of that have gone, because, of course, we haven't got the games for him to play for Barcelona between now and then. I suspect that what will happen is there will be discussions in the summer about the best way to manage this, but a lot will depend on what happens if indeed they play between now and then. And I think actually Braithwaite, even in the brief moments that he's played already, and he talked a lot about the way that he can be useful to the team, I think has impressed people. I think he's shown that he can be useful. I think he's shown that he can be a very, very useful squad player. And so I don't think it's impossible that he continues. I don't think it's hugely likely, of course, that he plays a starring role, because Luis Suarez will now be fit again if he plays. In the summer, the chances are they'll try to sign Lautaro Martinez, maybe even Neymar as well. Look, logic suggests he may well be on his way, but I don't think that we can rule out Braithwaite convincing them that he is worth keeping hold of.
Sid Lowe, thank you very much. More from Sid, by the way, over on the website, where he's been writing about La Liga's supercomputer and how it's been helping the coronavirus. Be sure to check it out.
Geico gets you access to licensed agents 24/7, which means that Geico is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like your mom, when you fill out really, really important paperwork on the first day of a new job.
Name, check. Birthday. Social security, is that a thing? Hey, mom, what is my social security number? Mom? Okay, let's guess. 0017. Oh, Gemini. Hashtag done.
Geico, always there for you with savings and 24/7 access to licensed agents.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
It's incredible to think that it was 7 years ago to the very day that Luis Suarez bit Branislav Ivanovic. Frank LaBeouf and Ali Moreno here alongside me to talk about how that affects his legacy regarding a footballer or a biter. Frank LaBeouf, when we've talked about this in the past, this is something that genuinely gets you quite angry.
Well, I'm not anymore. And I wish him the best for the rest of his life, let's say. He's almost at the end of his career, but that's a real momentum that my perception of a human being on the field changed in a way that I never thought that somebody would be able to not bite somebody once, but for the second time. And after will be a third time with Chiellini. So it made me think that that guy was a particular character and couldn't be a friend of mine. That's it. He's a fantastic football player, no doubt about that. But when you bite somebody once, then twice, then thrice, you maybe wonder what kind of person you are.
So no matter what happens, Frank, at the next World Cup, he could score 20 goals, be the absolute hero for Uruguay. You would still feel his legacy is tainted because of what happened?
Yes, it's tainted, exactly. Because I think when you love, you like, or you appreciate a player, it's because of its personality. It's not only what you see on the field. I'm completely fond of Edinson Cavani, his compatriot. The guy is a gentleman. He's a good-looking. He is polite. He has an education. On the field, he gives 100%. He's a fantastic player, and he seems to be a fantastic guy. So it's nothing personal against Luis Suarez. It's the all aspect of the personality that you have to take in account, and then you make up your mind. And I just did for Suarez, and I do it also for Edinson Cavani. So it doesn't matter if he scores 30 goals. My thought and the result of my thoughts about Suarez is done.
Ali, when you think of Luis Suarez, first thing comes into your mind, is it biter or great striker?
Great striker. And I think I can separate both of those things. I I can tell you, I didn't know that in order to become Frank Babu's favorite player, you had to be educated, good-looking, well-dressed, and all the other things that he mentioned. The truth of the matter is that, yes, he comes with the full package of Luis Suarez when you talk about him as a player, that he lives in the fringes of legality when it comes to the game. Now, you don't have to appreciate that. You don't have to like that. But I think what you can appreciate and what you have to like is his movement of the ball, his ability to create space, his ability to move off the shoulder of defenders, his ability to finish chances, and the fact that for every teammate that he's ever had and for every coach that he's ever had, have you ever heard anybody say anything negative about Luis Suarez, the teammate, Luis Suarez, the player, Luis Suarez, the person even inside the locker room? None of those things ever come up. In fact, more to the opposite. You talk or you hear coaches that have been part of Luis Suarez's team, and they tell you that this is one of those guys that you love to have because in every training session, because in every game, because in everything that he does, he gives you everything absolutely he has to give. And so I understand the frustration of people and the frustration of Frank when they talk about Luis Suarez and they see that this is a guy that, yes, will bite somebody, will provoke somebody, will cross the line, and will live on those fringes that I just spoke about, that he has mastered the dark arts of the game that perhaps are unnecessary to him, and yet he continues to do it. Well, it's part of his package. It's part of what he is as a player. And I can separate both things. And I can honestly tell you, he is a tremendous striker. And I don't really care whether he is a citizen of the world or whether he's going to win a fair play award and all those things. I'm not expecting that from Luis Suarez. What I'm expecting of him is to give me productivity and to give me a full effort. And I think he does that on a weekly basis.
Frank, I'll give you the last word on this.
Well, I think a football player has a duty of being an example at some point. You don't have to be perfect, of course, but you can be an example. I would have forgave Luis Suarez if it would happen only once, even maybe twice. But again, thrice, I think it's a little bit too much. And it says a lot about the personality. Okay, he's a good striker, fantastic striker, one of the best in the world at his when he was at his best. But it doesn't erase the character of the person. And you have to take that in account. I'm sorry, Ali, if you don't think that. And he would be a fantastic lawyer for Suarez in terms of football. And I will agree with you. But in terms of personality, I'm sorry. It doesn't match with the education I received from my parents.
Frank and his high horse will be joining us on Extra Time. Be sure to check that out over on our YouTube channel. He'll be joined by Ali to answer some of your tweets. I'm sure like you, nothing I like to do more on a Monday than peruse Gab's musings. And something certainly stood out to me as we welcome in the man himself, plus Mark Ogden. Look at this, two senior writers side by side. What a moment. Talk about five substitutes. Gab, this is something that could be introduced when football returns, and you love it.
Well, love it, I think, is a bit of a stretch. It's something I would like to see. I mean, they're talking, they've already introduced the possibility at UEFA level in the under-21s and I think under-19s as well. It's something that clubs have asked for. It's been talked about when the Premier League returns. It's been talked about when Serie A returns. Simply because, you know, if they are going to have to play so many games in such a short stretch, you want to avoid injury. You want to limit minutes on the pitch. One of the key things here is that the five substitutions, it's not like, you know, it would be those summer friendlies where you send out another substitute every minute. You would use those five substitutions. You can only use them three times a game. So you would see more double substitutions and things like that so as not to interrupt the flow. But I think the benefits in terms of fatigue, in terms of squad rotation, in terms of limiting minutes, and, of course, limiting injuries, I think it's a positive. I don't think there's any real reason why, you know, three is just an arbitrary number, frankly.
Mark, are you a fan of this?
Not really, no. I just think it's open to abuse, and I think that, you know, as it stands right now, it is abuse. You know, you get managers that will pick two or three subs in injury time to just run down the clock. What I'd do, I'd say no more substitutions after 85 minutes so that you can't waste time as much as you do in the final minutes. And yeah, I understand the injury situation, but, you know, players nowadays are so super fit. the tiredness thing doesn't come into it, because fatigue, now, players can run for 120 minutes. You've seen this in World Cups and European Championships where extra time doesn't separate the teams. Why do they need another advantage? For me, it just seems like an excuse for managers to give the players, the squad players of the game, just to get them off the back. So rather than have three subs a day, have five, and then, you know, in that way they can keep everybody happy, keep the squad happy, just encourage your team to have bigger squads.
Well, first of all, I don't see I would be any more open to abuse. It's not like you can interrupt the game any more times than you do now. You've got five substitutions, but you can only make substitutions three times in the course of a match. So I think that argument doesn't really apply here. I think sending on players who are fitter and hungrier, especially in situations where games are already decided, I think it would certainly make the game, liven the game up and make it more entertaining. But I think overall, it's a question of percentages, right? We see people suffer very serious injuries, whether it's Achilles or cruciates. It's simple math. If you can reduce somebody's minutes over the course of a season by 10%, you're also reducing the likelihood of injury by 10%. And, you know, this adds up over time.
Mark, do you agree this could liven things up, bringing on fresh legs?
No, I just think it would make it more stale. I just think mistakes happen when players are tired, you know, when fatigue creeps in mentally and physically. And I think the last 10, 15 minutes of games when most goals are scored because players are getting tired. If you kind of negate that by putting more fresh legs on, those late goals and those mistakes are going to be reduced, and then games are going to become more kind of stale affairs. I'd more than happily see a cut-off point of 80 minutes, 85 minutes, no more subs, and then let's see what happens. Let fatigue kick in, because how you manage fatigue is all part of the game. If players are fitter than their opponents, then great. But if you keep adding subs and fresh legs, nobody's going to get tired.
Gab, Mark's got a point, hasn't he? The fatigue does lead to mistakes, but it leads to goals, which is what we all want to see.
Well, look, if we just want to see lots of mistakes and lots of goals, then, you know, we can time travel back and go watch the non-league football from the 1970s. You know, isn't that a dawdle? A whole bunch of mistakes. I want to see teams that play well. I want to see people who are fit and well-rested and up for it. And I think that's what most people want to see. That's why players train, so they can be fit. If we just see mistakes, let's not have players train. Let's lock them in pubs all day, have them eat pizza all day, and then chuck them out on the pitch, and there'll be lots of mistakes, and we'll all have a lot of fun. I think the key thing here, as I said, this limiting time on the pitch, especially now when there's so much travel, when players have to play so many games, when they are so stretched, that even as sports science has improved and made people fitter in terms of the recuperation, time off the pitch, when you've got a niggly injury and you really should come off, I think all of this stuff matters. Simply, if you can reduce the minutes on the pitch, you reduce by that same percentage the likelihood that a player is going to get injured. I don't think this is going to be some sort of, you know, sea change in football, but it's something that clubs have asked for, and it's one of those things that I just don't see the reasonable argument against it other than bringing on fresh legs. And by the way, with fresh legs, presumably you're bringing on worse players. So there's a trade-off there. So we might still get to see those mistakes that Mark loves so much.
Well, I think the thing about injuries as well, that it's not a fact that injuries always occur late in games. You see a lot of times in the first 20 minutes of games when players haven't warmed up properly. You know, injuries happen in the first half of the game, the opening minutes of games, because the warm-up is a key part of the game. So it isn't just all about fatigue-related, it's preparation-related. And I think you can't iron out every flaw in the game. And I do think that if it's survival of the fittest players will last longer than their opponents, which is why they stand above everybody else. So if you're fitter than your opponent in the last 10 minutes, you win the game. It's not about mistakes. It's about fitter athletes, better athletes beating their opponents. So I just think with football nowadays, you can find so many elements. I agree it's all about improvement, but at some point you have to accept that it's a physical challenge as well as anything else. So forget the subs in the last 5 or 10 minutes and let players play for the 90 minutes or play to the, you know, play to the test of their endurance.
Gab, will this not just benefit the bigger teams? Like, we talk about Manchester City and the quality of their bench. They're going to benefit from this more than, say, someone like a Sheffield United, surely.
Will they? But Sheffield United can bring on fitter players. I mean, look, it's These are silly arguments. And the reality is, statistically, more injuries happen later in games. There's not an argument there. I agree. You can get injured rolling out of bed in the morning. But I think the point is, people in sports science, people in football clubs are asking for this. And I think it's something that should be considered. And I think it's something that is a positive. I appreciate, you know, the gladiatorial side of survival of the fittest and stuff like that. You know, if we had games lasting 5 hours, we could see who's really fit out there. And I think Mark would have fit in really, really well in ancient Rome, in the Roman Colosseum, where it was all gladiatorial. Me, I like to see players who are fit and whose bodies allow them to do the things that technically and skillfully they can do.
Just going back to my point, which you kind of ignored, Gab, City are going to benefit from this more than surely any other club, certainly when you take a look at their bench in the Premier League compared to others.
But you're arguing, let's think about what you're arguing logically. You're arguing that the drop-off from City starters to City's bench is less than the drop-off from Sheffield United starters, for example, and Sheffield United's bench. And in fact, if you look at the data, you notice that it really isn't the case that most teams in the Premier League, certainly, but I think in most other leagues, the drop-off from the starters to the bench, with when we're talking about starters, say, number 7 through 11, to the guys on the bench isn't that great, which is why a lot of teams towards the middle or the bottom of the table use so many players over the course of a season. They don't just stick to the core players, even though, by your logic, they should, because they play fewer games and because those guys are that much better. So, yeah, City have a lot of great players on the bench, but they have a lot of great players in the starting lineup, too. But the drop-off between the two, I think, is frankly negligible.
I'm going to give Mark Ogden the last word on that then, after that patronising tone.
Well, I think, like you say, Dan, that if you're Man City, you have a bench that may be worth £200 million in one game, as opposed to Sheffield United's maybe worth £50 million. So the quality of players on City's bench would outweigh the quality of those on the Sheffield United bench. So I'd imagine that if they're taking off Alexander Zinchenko at left-back and putting on Benjamin Mendy, that is a pretty decent exchange. There's no real drop-off in quality there. I think Sheffield United, as well as they've done this season, I think it'd be more difficult for them to replace a starting player with a player from the bench of equal quality. So the big teams would, again, be favoured by having more substitutes, because they've got a deeper squad with more expensive, high-quality players than their lower league, their lesser opponents in the lower half of the Premier League. So, again, it favours the big clubs, and I thought we're kind of trying to avoid giving all the advantages to the big team.
You did the drop-off between Mark Oliver Ogden McBurney and Lise Rousset.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. For more from Gab, you can check out the Gab and Jules podcast, which is available to download now. We'll end the show with reports in Holland saying that the Eredivisie won't start again until at least September 1st. So the assumption being that the season is over. We'll have a lot more on that on tomorrow's show. But for now, thank you very much to Gab, to Mark, to Frank, to Ali, and to Sid as well. More from us tomorrow. Till then, goodbye.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Napa Know How.
Get all the quality parts you need at your locally owned Napa. Because right now, when you order from Napa online, you can pick up curbside at your local store in just 30 minutes. Or get your order delivered direct to your door with free one-day shipping on over 160,000 quality parts when you spend $50 or more. Quality parts delivered quickly and safely. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating stores, standard ground shipping and exclusions apply.
Welcome into Extra Time. Thank you, as always, for your tweets. Ali Moreno with me, as is Frank LeBeuf. Frank, the first question is for you. If the 2018 France World Cup team, do you think they could beat the 2019 Champions League winning Liverpool side?
Oh, it's always hard to say a national team can beat a club team. especially the one, the Liverpool one, where we can see that they really stick together and they work very hard week in, week out. So, no, I think no chance for France 2018 to beat the Liverpool team. The 1998 team could have beaten Liverpool. But,
hey.
Not that one. Maybe.
Frank, that's nonsense though, isn't it? There is a big gap between domestic football and international football just because they have more time with each other. They have more time to gel, they have more time to work together. Even that 98 team, as good as you guys were, still surely this Liverpool team would be better just because day in, day out, they are together.
Yeah, but we were so good. No, I'm just teasing. Of course, I'm teasing. Of course, it's when you work week in, week out with your teammates, you're much better than any national team. And it's why the Champions League, it's the top of the top. But, you know, some teams, like maybe the Brazil in the 70s or I don't know, the Spain of 2000, the 2010, or they've been fantastic, and they share players from Real Madrid and Barcelona. So maybe they could have beaten a big club like Liverpool, a big team like Liverpool.
What do you think, Ali?
Well, I'm surprised that we didn't ask the actual question that should be asked, and that is the 98 France team against the 2018 France team. Having Frank here, he would give us the best answer, non-biased answer, and of course, I assume he would say the 98 France team would definitely be the 2018 team. Am I mistaken, Frank? You tell me.
Of course, my dear. Of course. We didn't win by luck the World Cup. I think my former teammate Didier Deschamps will agree that lots of circumstances made that the 2018 won the World Cup. But I think, yeah, we could say, I can say that the 84 won the European Championship team, national team, like with Michel Platini and Giroud, were much more better than 98. But I can say the 98 was better than 2018.
So let's go back to the 2018 team, Frank. How low do we have to go on the list for a team you think they could beat? So if we've got Liverpool, Manchester City, obviously Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Juventus, PSG, all of those teams, I think, is it fair to say that they could beat France 2018?
Yes, definitely. And it's not deeming the quality of that team. It's just saying that when you play for a club and you reach a Champions League, semi-final, you're much better than any national team because you know each other by heart, and there is no surprises, and you work every day to make sure that you follow the right tactic with your coach. So, yeah, it's as simple as that. Yeah, when you work with your club, you're most of the time better than any national team, I guess.
Let's go lower. Let's go Manchester United against that team. Who do you think, Frank?
No. I think France could beat that team, or could beat a many other team. We are talking about the best of the best. Manchester City, Liverpool, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Madrid, right. Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain. But otherwise, yeah, France in 2018 will have a chance, yeah.
Chelsea, Ali?
No, they don't beat the 2018 World Cup team from France. And here's the thing, when we're talking about the top-tier teams that Frank just mentioned, those are, I mean, you could very easily make the case, those are international teams. Those are superstars from all over the world that come together and on the same field on a weekly basis, and therefore become a version of an international team that are not representing one flag, but they're representing their club team domestically. All I can tell you is that the top-tier talent and top-tier teams, they are essentially international teams and all-star teams from all around the world. And so, yes, of course, If you have all-stars that work together on a weekly basis, you have to say, yeah, they would have an advantage on any national team. But once you start going down the list of teams and you get into the Manchester United or Chelsea when it refers to Premier League, I think you're reaching and you're taking away credit from what was a very good French national team and a deserving winner of the World Cup in 2018.
What if they had a year together, Ali? Would they beat Liverpool then?
If France had a year together, I think they would have a real chance.
They had a year training, you know.
I don't have a problem saying that they would beat Liverpool. Not at all. I when it comes to this conversation, because I know how you're steering the conversation, given what you, the spat that you have in, on Twitter with people regarding Champions League and the World Cup. So I know exactly in what path you're trying to take me into. But I do hold the World Cup in a very high place. And I think it's a premier competition for the sport. And so, regardless of whether you think it's a higher level or not, I do think that if you win the World Cup, you have to be an elite team. And if allowed to work together for an extended period of time, you will become that much better. And so I do think that you would be able to compete with anybody in the world in domestic competition if given the chance to prepare properly.
Okay. Right. God, that first question took a long time. Right. Next one. That's because of me, I know. Ali, how would you have dealt with Zidane?
How would I have dealt with Zlatan? Is that the question?
Oh, with Zlatan, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry. I let him be.
And now, if you haven't seen these quotes, a lot of his old teammates are coming out basically and crying and saying that he was a bully in the locker room.
And I didn't expect any differently. I didn't have to be in the locker room to know exactly that was the attitude that Zlatan would have taken. Now, I think what I would have done had I been a player inside that locker room is not necessarily go out of my way to earn his respect. Just do my work and do my job and do it well. And then put myself in a position where I'm the person who benefits, the beneficiary from Zlatan's presence out on the field. Because he's going to attract all the attention. I would be playing alongside with him, ideally, in the front line. And if he's attracting the attention, that means I'm going to be in a position where I'm going to be wide open to score goals. And I think the more goals you score, or the more ability that you show Zlatan that you can combine with him, the more he's going to respect your game. And if he respects your game and respects you as a player, I don't think there would have been any issues whatsoever.
Frank, this is a story that's been breaking in America over the last few weeks. Former teammates at the Galaxy coming out and saying, Zlatan said, look, I've got $300 million. I've got an island. I don't need this. I need you to be on my side. Do you have any problems with that?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't care about how much money he has in his bank account and if he owns an island. But I like the way he... Even if he was rich and maybe reach the level that he wanted to reach, I agree with the fact that he wants to send a message to the other player. I don't like to lose, and I want you to know that I don't like to lose, and I don't like the way we lost that game. So I'm really fond of Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I think he's a guy who changes a dressing room, who changes even a league, and the way some players can think about the business that they are in. I really have no problem with that. And as Ali, I would have served him the best I could, make sure that he respects me, and it would have been a great atmosphere in the dressing room between him and I. I don't have any problem with that.
Ali, I know it's naive from my point of view. It's the same question I asked Herc yesterday. MLS locker room soft in comparison to others?
It can be. I don't know that the word is soft as much as it is that a lot of the players don't quite have the experiences that some of these other players that are coming in from Europe and from other parts in the world have had. And when you haven't had those sort of experiences, then you sort of take a step back when somebody gets in your face. And I think what you learn when you play internationally, when you play in other places, when you go with your national team, is that the last thing that you can do in an environment of high level of competition, of alpha personalities, is take a step back. Because the moment that Zlatan Ibrahimovic realizes that you're the sort of guy who take a step back, he's going to keep coming forward and he's going to continue to try to test you and see what you can produce. And I think the reasoning behind it would be for a guy to Zlatan and say, hold on a second, if this guy cannot take the pressure that I put on him in the locker room or in the training ground or in the training facility, and every time that I pass in the ball, I cannot trust for him to do a job, how am I going to trust him during the game? And so I think it happens a lot in when you go to a national team environment, when you go into a different level of play, that you have to be able to prove your worth. And I think a lot of players in Major League Soccer are not quite ready for that just yet. And so when a guy with a personality of Zlatan comes in, and from the moment he sets foot in that locker room, starts testing everybody, he is taking full stock of the players that are going to be able to help him and the ones that are not. And the ones that are not going to help him, I tell you what, a guy like Zlatan does not hesitate in putting those guys to the side and continue his path forward, because it is what he has done over the course of his career. So to be fair to Zlatan, this is not something specific to Major League Soccer. This is something that he has done in just about every locker room he has been a part of. And he has spoken his mind and said the things that he's wanted to say. And there's a reason as to why he hasn't lasted in teams for much longer than a couple of years at a time. So this is who he is as a player, and you know full well that he was going to bring that into the locker room if you were a Galaxy player. So you should not have been surprised that he was testing you from the moment he got there.
He would make me cry, wouldn't he, Ali?
Yes, he would. Yes, very quickly. Day one. Uh-huh. Preseason. Yes, day one.
Okay, why did Chelsea not win the Premier League in Frank's era, even though they were star-studded?
I think we didn't have the experience. We came, and I think we were like 17 different nationalities inside the squad. And simply, we had two better teams in front of us, the Gunners and Manchester United. At the time, they were fantastic players belonging to those two teams, and it was hard to cope with them. I think in 98-99, or maybe the year after, we lost only three games during the season, but drew too many times, and Manchester United, I don't remember, Arsenal was, no, Manchester United was the champion, and we finished third. They had more experience, they knew how to cope with the Premier League. They were, you know, you have to win what we say dirty games, in order to be a champion. Sometimes when you go to, so-called smaller teams, you have to win that game. And sometimes we lost, sometimes we drew. It wasn't enough. We lost only three times, but it was enough to not finish even in as a runner-up. So we finished third. Happy. We launched, I think, the new era of Chelsea, but not strong, not experienced enough at some point to win the league.
Right, Ali. We're talking sprinting. Over 60 meters, your speciality. Who's winning in this race? Kylian Mbappe, Iñaki Williams, or Adam Traoré?
Well, if there was a fight at the end of the 60-meter race, then I would want Adama Traore with me. Because clearly, the man, I tell you, whether he admits it or not, he has some muscle on him. So I would assume that he would be helpful in a fight. But because I don't think there's a fight involved at the end of this, I'm going to take Kylian Mbappe. His acceleration, I think, is superior to that of Iñaki Williams and Adama Traore. I think Iñaki Williams is more over distance sort of speed, and Adama Traore is just a whole lot of power coming behind you. But I'm going to take Mbappe because I have seen it with this guy. Over short distance and over long distance can definitely be the fastest of the three.
Last question, Frank. It's a doozy for you. Who is the better, or who was the better, centre-back? Desailly, Blanc, or LeBouf?
Ooh.
Ooh. I will put Marcel Desailly because he always been, well, he played a little bit midfield when he was playing for Milan, but he has the culture as a central defender. He was the rock, barely tackled because he was never at the extreme. He was always very well positioned and he was very hard to move. Laurent Blanc was a midfield player, offensive midfield player at the beginning of his career. I played before joining my first professional club as a midfield player as well. So we didn't have the central defender characteristic, mainly main characteristic, meaning very strong defenders. But I think we were both, Laurent and myself, better in passing the ball, working tactically and also thinking in advance what we had to do. But if we talk only as a character of a central defender, Marcel Desailly was from far the best central defenders.
Good stuff. Thank you very much, guys. Much appreciated. ESPN FC back on your screens tomorrow. Be sure to join us.